All right. Thank you, ladies, for having me come. I was telling some Elizabeth and Ellen back there, I got a date off of school to be here. It was great. If I move this to the side, will that be
wherever you need it?
Okay. Yeah. I may seem sweet and nice, but if you do talk in class, I promise I can be me.
Amen.
So.
They need it.
All right, ladies. So my topic tonight is, we know that loving one another is powerful. And you can turn to 1 John 4, and we will stay there for the most part. I will read some other scriptures, but that'll get you there. So how are you at passing tests? Do you get the test anxiety? Do you get scared of the thought of tests? I have a reoccurring nightmare that it'll come out of nowhere, it seems like. I won't have it for years. And I'll have this same nightmare where I go into class and there's a test and I haven't studied. And it's funny that that's my nightmare, because it actually happened to me twice in college. So I prepped my kids and I said, if you go into class and there's a test, you go out the door and you ask for forgiveness later, but don't stay in there. But, so I guess I do get some test anxiety. As a teacher, I do a lot of things to help my kids feel like, you know, you don't have to be anxious about the test. Their favorite thing that I do is I give them encouragements. So they're just mints. They're peppermints, lifesaver peppermints. There are studies that say that peppermint helps to wake up your brain. So I tell them, there's scientific proof this will help you on the test. At least they can believe that, right? And they think they're really getting away with something, because candy's illegal in our building, and I'm right across from the president's office, and I say, the eagle's not in the nest. We can have encouragements. Really, I don't think he would care, but it makes, you know, the whole legend makes it better. We do positive affirmations, and I say, we are ready for this test. We're going to do okay. I do review games. My favorite's the unfair game, because I tell them before it starts, it's unfair. So you can't complain at the end and tell me it wasn't fair. But I do things to get them to feel like they don't need to be anxious about the test. It's going to be okay. But you know what? Sometimes they aren't prepared. And I tell them, you know what? You should be scared. You didn't study last night. You haven't done any homework this whole unit. You should be scared. You should be afraid. I do that the night before the test to try to encourage them to study, right? How do you feel about people? I'm just getting nosy here, right? Social media, you see all these posts about how I hate people. Everything would be great if it wasn't for people. I am an introvert, but I don't hate people. I'm an introvert because I like... I get my energy from being at home and being in small groups. It's not that I hate being in large groups. It's not that I'm shy. It's just that doesn't energize me. That drains me. And when I'm home alone, that's great. My husband's the exact opposite. So when he leaves for a week, he's like, I'm so sorry I'm leaving you. And I'm like, why? Every night. It's going to be great. But, you know, society really suffers from a lack of true connection. We've seen that. It became so evident during COVID, right? There are lots of opportunities in that void, though, to show the love of God, right? A lot of opportunities for us. One more question. How do you feel about your salvation? After our lesson tonight, we're really thinking about it. That's a big question, and it might seem like a non sequitur, right? Like, why are you asking me about tests? Why are you asking me about people? Why are you asking me about salvation? But the book of 1 John teaches us that our love of people is a test that measures our salvation. So we need to be prepared and we need to understand. Let's take a look at the theme of 1 John and the purpose. At Forest Park, we started this 18-month study. We started it in January. No. We started it in August. And then we had the whole hurricane month. So where are we now? I don't know. But we are looking at the Bible as a whole, and when Wesley first told me about it and said, we're going to do it for 18 months, it's going to not be like you're going to study, you know, the whole book of Genesis. It's going to be two lessons on Genesis and then two lessons on Exodus. You're going to go through and through and through. And I said, well, that sounds really boring, but it's actually been very good. I've really learned a lot, and it's challenged me as the ladies' teacher, but... So I like to take this bird's eye view now. It's making me think about that more. But 1 John was written to help early Christians feel assurance about their salvation. That's the point of the book, his purpose for writing it. And it is a letter, but it's not like other letters. It's really a lot more like a poem. And it cycles through a couple ideas. It's not real laid out and organized like maybe some of Paul's writings, but it's much more flowy. So the first cycle of ideas that it flows through is that you need to follow the light. That's one test, our light. Follow righteousness. If you want to be saved, you have to obey God. There's no getting around that. That's the first idea he cycles through. And then the second idea he cycles through is love, that we have to love like Christ. Our love then becomes this ultimate test for us of our salvation. Everything's on the line. This isn't test anxiety. This isn't my nightmare where I might get a bad grade on a test. But this is about eternity, right? So it's something it's good for us at times to stop and think about our eternity. Not to be scared, but like my kids, when I try to give them a little fear before the test to get to motivate us to act, to motivate us to change and make adjustments and live for Him. So 1 John chapter 4, verse 7 through 21, the big idea in that whole section is love. And let's read. So I left my Bible in the hotel. I left my Bible in the hotel, so I'm using my phone Bible. I apologize. All right. Verse 7 and 8 says, "Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love." God is love. That's a really big thought. That's a really big concept. It's life-changing because we learn from that that God is the definition of what it is to be loving. And any other definition that we have falls short of what God is and His example to us. Here's a quote that I'm going to read from a preacher that I thought was wonderful about this subject. "God's absolute fullness of life and truth and beauty and goodness and all other perfections is such that He is not only self-sufficient, but also in His very nature resourceful. Overflowing. God is so absolute, so perfect, so complete, so full, so inexhaustibly resourceful, so joyful, that He is by nature a giver, a worker for others, a helper, a protector. What it means to be God is to be full enough always to overflow and never to need, never murmur, never pout. God is love. The implications of this for the way we live are big." I murmur. I pout sometimes. I do not always overflow. At least I feel like I don't have an overflow. I don't have enough to give all these kids. Yes, I teach middle school. I'm also the lead teacher. And the best that I can describe that is I'm a mom to about 70 kids. And it's just as fun as it sounds some days, right? Because I'm also the mom to the other teachers there. So if they're having trouble, they send them to me. I don't feel like I have that. It is a personal struggle of mine to try to remind myself daily what is my purpose, that I need to be overflowing with love, that I need to show love. But God, He's the joyful giver, right? God is the fountain whence 10,000 blessings flow. Psalm 136:26 says, "Give thanks to the God of heaven, for His steadfast love endures forever." Psalm 103:17 says, "But the steadfast love of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear Him, and His righteousness to children's children." Isaiah 54:10, "For the mountains may depart and the hills may be removed, but my steadfast love shall not depart from you, and my covenant of peace shall not be removed, says the Lord." Deuteronomy 7:9, "Know therefore that the Lord your God is God, the faithful God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love Him and keep His commandment to 1,000 generations." It is my propensity to try to define love on my own terms. It's all of ours. That's our limited ability, right? And I am a changing person. So my definition of love may change. But God's love is defined by obedience to his commandments. That's what Glenn Colley talked about last night, right? Obedience to that truth. It is eternal and it is unchanging. We can know what his expectations are. We can know what love is. We know that homosexuality is not love, no matter how many shirts you want to get that say it. We know it's not, because God defines love. He is love. You don't get to define it in a way that is opposite of him. We know that church discipline is loving, because it's something that God expects of us. We know that disciplining our children is loving, no matter what this new gentle parenting trend says. And I'm telling you, if you don't know what it is, it's really disturbing. It is about not saying no ever. That's what it is. We know that gender roles in the home and in the church are loving. It is not unloving to say that a woman cannot preach. We know that because God is love, and this is what he's commanded. We don't define love because our definition of love would ever be changing. But God is love. He defines what it is to be love, and that changes everything. We also know from this text in verse 9 and 10 that God's love was revealed through his Son. Let's read those two. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent this his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for us. That's a foundational doctrine, isn't it? Christ's death on the cross was the greatest act of love of all time. It is, and according to the scriptures, the manifestation of God's love for us, right? When it became a thing, that thing was Christ dying on the cross. It is the answer to his wrath. It is the only thing that satisfies that. That's why it's the propitiation for our sin. Verse 11, if you go on and read, says that it demands our love and respect in return. It is the ultimate overflow of love and self-sacrifice. Look at Philippians 2, probably one of my favorite passages in the Bible because it challenges me so much. Philippians chapter 2. And we'll start at verse 3. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves. Not looking to your own interest, but each of you to the interest of others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as is in Christ Jesus. This is going to help us live without selfish ambition or vain conceit, right? Who, being in the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. He was God, and he was willing to empty himself of that and be a human. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on the cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God. Do you want to know how to love? Be like Christ. Be self-sacrificing. Give your time and energy to other people. That's what he did. That was his whole mission the time he was on earth. It was not about himself in any way. That's the number one thing that I know my students want of me. They put that on surveys all the time. What would you like of your teachers? I want to have a relationship with them. That's what my children want, right? My daughter calls me every night. Late, these college kids and their hours. And a lot of times she'll say, oh, I'm sorry, were you in bed? And I'll say, uh-huh. And then she'll proceed to tell me about her day, starting with, I woke up at 8. Okay? But she wants me to be there for her. She wants me to hear, right? That's what my friends want from me. That's what my family wants from me, my time and my energy. This means that I need to do things to stay full, right? I can't give all of my time and energy to work. Even though when I work for someone, I work as for the Lord, right?
and I owe them 100%. But there's still other people in my life who I also owe 100%. So I have to find balance in that. That means that I have to take time to study the God's Word, right? That's going to fill my heart up. I have to take time for that daily. When I am struggling to be kind to people, I almost with 100% can tell you that I have been neglecting my personal Bible study. I've been neglecting prayer. And I got to get myself right so that I can be a little more kind. I have to do time and priority management to make sure that I am putting other people first. And that is a constant struggle for me as a person who has a very type A personality. And I am success-oriented. I usually find myself in positions of leadership. That's just the way that it goes. And so it's hard for me not to be driven by the goal. And some of you are like that. Some of you think, you're a terrible person. I'm sorry, I'm really not. Okay? It's just not how God made me. But that means that it's a constant struggle for me to say it's not about the goal. This lesson that I'm teaching at school today is not the most important thing in my classroom. It's the souls of my children. I have to be conscientious of that. I have to put the needs of others first. I have to see people, and we'll talk more about that later. I have to be self-sacrificing in all situations. We're reading The Outsiders in 8th grade right now, which if you've never read, you should. It's really good. I've read it like 6 times already. But there's this scene where a couple characters go against expectations, which is a lot of what the book is about, that we can defy expectations. And they run into a burning building. And another character encourages them not to do that. And they do end up getting hurt, very seriously hurt, because they run into a burning building to save children. And so I ask the question at the end when they have to write in their little reflection journals to say, was it right for him to dissuade them? And the first question is always, what does dissuade mean? But then it's always, it's universal. They say, well, they did get hurt. So, yeah, I understand that they wanted to run in, but I also understand why I told them not to, because they did get hurt. And I remind them every time, it's always right to do right, and it's never right to do wrong. Even if that means personal sacrifice, it's always right to do right. So even if we know that there's a burning building and there's children in it and we might get hurt, we don't just let the children die. Sometimes you have to tell 8th graders that. Remember your mission. Be mission-oriented. What is the priority? We've got to keep it in the forefront. And then in verses 11 and 12 of chapter 4 of 1 John. I have to turn back there. Sorry. 1 John 4, 11 and 12. Because of this, because of the fact that God is love, because of God's love revealed to us through his Son and his death on the cross, we ought to love each other. This should be the natural response. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. Complete there doesn't mean, some of your versions probably say perfect. God's love is perfect, right? He doesn't need us to perfect him. It's talking about this concept of being complete and completion. So it like brings it first full circle. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I know Wesley's going to talk about that tomorrow, so I won't steal his thunder. But that is the natural response in God's loving us, is that we should love others. In verse 18, he says, we love others not with words or speech, but with deeds and truth. So let's see. Let's put our money where our mouths are. Let's take the test. These questions I didn't come up with, but I thought they were so powerful. So, do you pass the test? When you hear a description of love like 1 Corinthians 13, right, all the things that love is, or when you contemplate the example of Christ's life of love, does your heart fill with longing to be like that? Do you make firm resolves to conquer unloving attitudes and behaviors? That's a good question to ask yourself. I shortened it up there for you. Does hearing about Christ's love or reading 1 Corinthians 13 make you want to become more loving and overcome unloving attitudes? When you fail in a resolve of love, Does it grieve you and bring you broken to the cross, pleading for forgiveness and seeking new strength to love again? You all, I mean, any of you who've parented middle school kids, you understand, and we all have been there if we haven't parented them, right? Girls are, can be so mean, and there's always going to be girls drama. It's my favorite thing. But the sixth graders, there was some girl drama going on, and a mom brought it to my attention. And she told me that a couple girls didn't like where one girl was sitting at lunch, and so they said, we'll buy you an ice cream if you don't sit there next time. So I talked to these girls after, and I said, did you offer to buy an ice cream so that you, she wouldn't, that you'd sit with you? They said, yeah, but it wasn't like that. And I said, well, tell me what it was like. And they bought her an ice cream so that she wouldn't sit with them again. It was exactly like that. So, but it wasn't me. And I said, but it was. Because what if I said, I'll pay you $5 if you'll quit coming to my class? And they're like, but it's not like that. I was like, but it was. But it hurt her feelings. And they continued to argue with me about whether or not it was wrong. One was very embarrassed and repentant. And I had to just, I mean, sometimes I can be blunt, ladies. I told you I could get mean. You just don't see my mean side. And I had to just say, you are being ugly. You need to tell her you're sorry. And we don't buy people ice cream to not sit with us. Or other treats. But then, to make matters worse, as we do in sixth grade, because we're not fully developed, right? She went to the bathroom and yada about it. The little girl that she had bought the ice cream for was in the bathroom in a stall. So then I had lot of girls from all grades coming to me, very excited to tell me the tea. Susanna's now crying in the stall, and Kelby's crying because she said it a lot. So then I'm talking to Kelby after. I should change the names. Her name is Karen. Don't look at my role. But anyway, I talked to Susanna and I said, I'm really sorry this happened to you. I'm going to talk about it. Okay. And she went on to classroom. And of course, they're in my class after too. But I talked to little Karen out in the hall. And I just said, okay, what did you do wrong? I didn't do anything wrong. Somebody was in there and they asked me what happened and why I was upset. So I told them. And I said, but you could have said it's none of your business because it was about another girl, right? But they asked me, and I was upset, and I didn't do anything wrong. I'm sorry she was in there. I told her I'm sorry. And I said, you aren't hearing me. You have made a bad situation worse. And she continued to believe she had not done anything wrong. Bless their hearts. So I told her. Finally coming full circle of this, sorry. I told her, here's the problem. And she was very worried I was going to give her a guideline infraction notice, which is a card that says you might get in trouble if you do something again. I said, you're more concerned with whether or not you're going to be in trouble right now. And your heart is not hurting over the fact that you just talked about another little girl in front of you, a little girl that you have already made cry herself to sleep. I said, that's the problem. And she still didn't think she did anything wrong. So I called her mama, and her mama was on it. So, but, you know, sometimes we can be that stubborn in our own hearts, and we can say all these reasons why we had the right to be unloving. Yes, sometimes I talk to my husband, Rue, but do you understand how stupid he is? Do you know how bad my kids are? Yeah, I lose my temper with them because they're so bad. That's not loving, and it's not an excuse. We should be repentant. We should feel bad. One more test. Is the current pattern of your life to live for the eternal good of other people, or are your thoughts and dreams and daily choices generally aimed at merely making yourself comfortable and your name esteemed? Are you living your life for the good of others, or is most of your time spent on yourself? That's a hard question. So let's look at a little practical application. The title of the lesson is Why Loving Others is So Powerful. Let's talk about it. Loving others first, it requires our humility. God, multiple times in the Bible, my husband says it's somewhere in Psalms, but I know it's in 1 Peter 5, 5 and 6, and James 4, 6 and 7 says that God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. I started swapping it around. He says it multiple times because apparently it's something that we struggle with and need to hear again and again, right? 1 John 3, so let's go one chapter earlier because, again, it's more like a poem and it kind of cycles through these ideas. So he cycles through the idea of love in chapter 3 as well. Let's start in verse 10, 11, and 12. This is how we know who the children of God are and who the children of the devil are. Anyone who does not do what is right is not God's child, nor anyone who does not love their brother or sister. There's not a lot of room in that. There's not a lot of gray area in that. Verse 11, for this is the message you heard from the beginning. We should love one another. Do not be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own actions were evil and his brother's were righteous. Jealousy was at the root of that sin, right? And it was jealousy that resulted from his own pride. How could it be that my brother's sacrifice was good and mine wasn't? That's pride. Being a loving person would have required him to humble himself and be proud for his brother, right? I'm so glad that yours was acceptable. I want to learn from you, brother. Help me to be acceptable like you. That takes a lot of humility. Being loving helps us because it helps us to be humble. Remember that mind of Christ we talked about in Philippians 2. It's all about self-sacrifice. It's all about putting others first. It's only then that we begin to resemble him. My tendency, this is going to sound like a terrible person, but this is my tendency, ladies, and I know if it's mine, other people struggle with it too, but my tendency is to think legitimately, but I know I'm focused on myself right now because my things are very important. And what that is saying is, and yours aren't. Right? Well, you don't know what I have going on. I got a lot going on right now. It's really important. The world, I tried to look up a lesson. I'm trying to remember what exactly the search was that I was trying to do for the kids about being selfless. And everything that came up in Google was about self-care and putting yourself first. Everything. Like, I couldn't find anything, any lessons for middle school kids that was about putting others first. Like, middle schoolers need to focus on self more. Come on. Loving yourself is good. That's a good thing. We're supposed to love our neighbors as ourselves. Implied in that is that you love yourself and you see good in yourself. That is good. Elevating yourself, that's harmful. Only living for yourself, that's sinful. Right? That's what leads us to sin. So loving others is powerful because it requires our humility. It forces us to be humble. Loving others is powerful because it lifts others up. Don't underestimate the power of one little act of kindness, right? Hebrews 10, 24 and 25. Let's look at that. How's my time? Okay.
Is that time or
seven?
Okay.
Is that
nine?
Okay. 15 minutes? Hebrews 10, 24 and 25 says, and let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. Part of our purpose in meeting together is to love one another and encourage one another. They go together. They're hand in hand, right? Let's turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And we'll start at verse 11. Therefore, encourage one another and build each other up, just as in fact you are doing. Okay, this is something we're supposed to do. Verses 12 through 18 then go through and they list all these qualities that help us accomplish that goal. How are we to encourage one another and build each other up? It says things like showing appreciation to our leaders. It says esteeming our leaders, meaning our spiritual leaders. Getting along with other people. Admonishing the unruly is one way we can encourage one another. Encouraging the faint-hearted, helping the weak, being patient with everyone. Oh, that's hard. Avoiding vindictiveness and revenge. Paying back evil with good. Rejoicing, praying, being grateful. Those are all qualities that lift one another up. Those are all qualities that show love, are they not? Those are all things that are loving one another. Our words and our actions have the power to bring people up or to put them down. We know that Proverbs 8:21, the tongue has the power over life or death, right? We can hurt people, we can kill people with our tongue. We've seen this. I know this about you, that each of you holds in your heart something harsh or thoughtless that someone said to you at some time, and it may be years ago, and you remember it. You remember it. Wesley will talk about, and he doesn't like lose sleep over it, but he will talk about this girl in middle school who put his shoes on her little book holder under the desk. And she said, get your generic shoes off my desk. And I don't know if you didn't grow up in the 80s and 90s, but generic was bad, okay? And after that, it made sense when he told me that story, because in high school he was all about having name brand clothes, and I didn't care. But I'm sure that message went through his head. He remembers it now, and he's nearly 50. He would really be mad at me for putting his age that way. I'm just saying, when you round up, he goes to 50. But it stays with them, and I try to tell my kids that, and I try to tell myself that about, as a teacher to them, that one word that you say they can remember forever, right? Loving others lifts others up. That's powerful. Loving others lets others see God. Probably the most powerful. It is that perfection that I talked about earlier, that completion of God's love, is that we show love to others. Look at 1 John 4 and verse 12. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. Get down to 16 and 17. And we know and rely on the love God has for us. God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in them. This is how love is made complete among us, so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment. In this world, we are like Jesus. That's how we make it complete. How do we make it complete? Live in this world like Jesus. That's how we complete God's love. His love is perfect, but it's incomplete because he's put us to do that mission on earth. This is the natural outcome of God's love. If you know he loves you, it's how you should respond. In this, others see us. We know that from Matthew 5, right, the Sermon on the Mount, let your light show shine so that others may see your good works and glorify your Father's in heaven. Jesus saw people who were unloved and unlovable, right? He saw that Samaritan woman at the well, who was there at the wrong time of day, right? At high noon, getting water. Why was she there? Because she was not acceptable in society. Because she was not lovable. She had several different husbands. Now that we live in this probably over-psychoanalyzed time, right, we know that if you're cycling through men, there's probably something inside you that's missing. You're probably not choosing very good men. You probably don't feel very loved. He saw her. He reached out to her. And that helped her to see God. It changed a whole village. He saw the woman with the flow of blood. We're reading through Leviticus in our... So in part of our curriculum that we're going through all the books of the Bible, we're all reading through the Bible together. And so Monday and Tuesday, we read Old Testament. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we read New Testament. But we left off in Leviticus with all the flows of blood and rashes. Mm-hmm. It was just fascinating. But if you had a flow of blood, you had to be separate and apart for 7 days, right? And if it touched anybody else, they had to. This woman in her society was an outcast. She'd had a flow of blood for 12 years. She's probably going crazy. I would be. She was going crazy enough that she was just crazy enough to go touch somebody's garment, hoping that it would work. And he saw her. And it changed her life. He saw blind Bartimaeus on the road when he called out. How many people walked by him? He saw the little children. And they said, send those little children away. And he said, let the little children come to me. Jesus saw people. And they, in turn, saw God because of his acts of loving kindness. It's full circle. Read verse 19 there in chapter 4. We love because he first loved us. It's the way that we make his love complete. Okay, I'm going to try something. You're my guinea pigs. I'm going to try to do this thing that's called a Mentimeter. So if you have a QR reader, or most of you, if you have any kind of a new phone, get it out. If you just use a camera option, it'll probably take you to this Mentimeter, okay? So use your camera option. If you need help, we'll help you. But get your camera out and put it on that, and there'll be a little, some words that show up under it, and if you click on that, it'll take you to this Mentimeter. And on the Mentimeter, I want you to think of someone who truly loves you. Preferably not your husband, but that's okay. That's the person that you're like, that's the only one I know truly loves me. Okay. What quality did they possess that made all the difference to you? It made you know they loved them. It made you feel that love. One or two words only, please. Maybe it was their humility. Maybe it was their listening. Maybe it was their caring. What was it about them? Maybe it was their patience with you. What was it about them? One or two words only, please. It'll have a little survey, and there's three different options, and if you want to list three things, you are absolutely more than welcome to do that. But three one or two word things. You'll see why in just a minute. What were the things that really spoke to you and made a difference to you because they loved you? Was it the time they spent with you? I've got a friend who all the time tells me, I just appreciate that you take time for me. I'm like, we're friends. It's really not a big deal. Okay, does anybody else need a QR code? Can I move off of that?
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully this works. Oh, good. It is. All right, on this little Mentimeter are all the words that you all are typing in. And the bigger the word, the more people said it. People said listening was a big one. We want to be heard, especially as women, don't we? We want to be heard. Compassion, I like it. Perspective. They reached out. Acceptance. Somebody put a name of a person. I love that. Tasha, they prayed. They gave their time, their trust. Their patience, caring, that's what Wesley said, cared. Transparency, I like that. We talked a lot, we had a really good girls' chapel once about being vulnerable and how Jesus was vulnerable to people and how much that invites people in. That's that honesty, acceptance, being generous, understanding, unconditional love. I see patience on there multiple times. Praying, quality time, pure truth. They hugged you. I love it. Helpful advice. Feeling included. All right. These things that you all are sharing, that's the power of loving one another. Those are the things that spoke to you. Go and do likewise. Make his love complete. Do for others the things that made you feel that way. You know, I talked in the beginning, I'll let that keep going. I talked in the beginning about tests and helping my kids to feel like they're not so anxious about it. Look at verse 20 and 21 of chapter 4. Whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or sister is a liar. Whoever does not love their brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. And he has given us this command. Anyone who loves God must love also their brother and their sister. Being loving is the ultimate test. He repeats it throughout that book, 1 John 2:9. Remember, I said it's cyclic. 1 John 2:9. Anyone who claims to be in the light but hates his brother or sister is still in the dark. 1 John 3:14. He who does not love abides in death. And then the scripture we read. I talked about the talk I have to give some of my kids. This is our talk. If we're not loving, we should be afraid. We should be afraid. Afraid enough to make change. That's the good news. There's still time. There's still today. We know how. We know how. We know what being loved feels like. We know what it looks like. And we know what makes a difference in people's lives. So do it. It's not too late. Go out and do likewise. Thank you, ladies.